We'll call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order when we have a quorum. We are very fortunate today to have with us Dan Mitchell from the Cato Institute. And just so the member knows that's here, we're going to be the agenda for today is we're going to have a 10-minute presentation, then we're going to have up to 10 minutes for questions, then we're going to have what's the next 10 minutes? Department of Revenue to talk about it, and then we're going to have about 10 minutes kind of a background on Green Acres, then we're going to start hearing the Lemire bill. It'd be my intention to vote on that bill today and either pass it or passes or doesn't pass, I guess. So Mr. Dan Mitchell is with us from the Cato Institute. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir, and make your presentation. And welcome to Minnesota.
Well, thank you very much, sir. My name is Dan Mitchell. I'm a senior fellow at the Cato Institute in Washington. I suppose by way of background, the one thing that would tie me most to this committee is I worked for the ranking Republican on the Senate Finance Committee in Washington, where we discussed some of these very same issues about how to properly estimate the revenue impact of changes in tax law. And to give a sort of a brief summary of my formal presentation that I'll submit for the record, the issue of what is sometimes known as dynamic scoring versus static scoring, or what's sometimes known as Laffer curve analysis, simply deals with whether or not taxpayers respond to or change their behavior in response to changes in tax rates. And perhaps a good way of giving an explanation of this would be to give a story from my days with Senator Packwood. In Washington, our revenue estimates are done, at least on Capitol Hill, by the Joint Committee on Taxation. We also have an Office of Tax Analysis in the Treasury Department. And in 1989, Senator Packwood sent a letter to our Joint Committee on Taxation in Washington, and he asked them, what would be the revenue impact if you taxed all income above a certain level at 100%? And he, of course, took a couple of weeks to get a response back, but the Joint Committee on Taxation responded. I'm going to see if I can find the exact data right here. The Joint Committee on Taxation responded by saying you would increase revenue not only the first year, but the second year, the third year, and the fourth year. In other words, even at a 100% tax rate, the government would have permanent revenue increases as a result of a 100% tax rate. And so Senator Packwood responded to the Joint Committee on Taxation, and I'll be more colloquial than he was in the letter. He basically said, are you guys crazy? Do you really think people will continue to earn and report income if the government confiscates 100% of the additional revenue? And so the Joint Committee on Taxation, and he said, please get back to me. Think about this for a bit. So the Joint Committee on Taxation sent back the exact same revenue estimate, but this time they put in a asterisk, and that asterisk said that our revenue estimates do not account for any possible changes to the economy as a result of changes in tax law. And actually, I'm looking at the data now. The Joint Committee on Taxation estimated that the revenue impact of a 100% tax rate would go from $104 billion in 1989 up to $299 billion in 1993. And what this underscores is that the conventional approach of governments, of what is known as static scoring, is fundamentally misguided when you're talking about significant changes in tax policy. Now, most government revenue estimating bodies do factor in what are called microeconomic responses. So, for instance, if you increase the tobacco tax, yes, they will. They do understand that fewer people will smoke, or at least they might buy cigarettes in the black market or something like that. But what these revenue estimates do not do is they do not factor in that you might actually have a change in the economy's growth rate. And where this tends to be very important is when you have tax changes on people that are highly sensitive or have high ability to respond to changes in tax policy. And I want to cite some data from the 1980s that I think underscores this. It's an extreme example, but it shows the importance of this issue. When Reagan took office in 1981, we had a top tax rate in America of 70%. By the time he left office, the top tax rate was 28%. And, of course, there was a lot of controversy in Washington whether that was fair. That's, of course, a subjective judgment. But there was also a debate on whether or not this meant that rich people wouldn't pay enough revenue to the government. Well, every year the IRS produces something called the Statistics of Income Bulletin. And if you go to the IRS website, even today, you can look at the 1980 Statistics of Income Bulletin. It will show the amount of income for people making over $200,000 a year, how many of those people there were, how much income they reported to the government, and how much federal revenue was the result. And in 1980, with a top tax rate of 70%, you had about 117,000 rich people under that definition. They reported about $36 billion of income to the IRS, and Uncle Sam got about $19 billion of revenue from those rich people. Well, by 1988, the top tax rate had fallen all the way from 70% down to 28%. Did that mean that the amount of revenue paid by the rich went from $19 billion down to $8 billion, $12 billion, $15 billion? Well, if you go to the IRS website, look at the 1988 Statistics of Income Bulletin, you'll find that the number of rich people went from 117,000 to about 724,000. The amount of taxable income they reported to the government went from $36 billion to $353 billion, and the amount of revenue the government got at a 28% tax rate from the rich was $99 billion compared to $19 billion, which was the amount of revenue they got at a 70% tax rate. Now, giant caveats should apply to this, because we had 40% plus inflation during those 8 years. We had 7 to 8% population increase. There were other economic policy reforms, such as bringing down inflation, the transportation deregulation that actually began during the Carter years, all sorts of policies that probably contributed to an increase in economic growth, an increase in the number of rich people, an increase in the amount of taxable income they reported. So we have no idea, if we want to be completely honest, we have no idea whether the lower tax rates themselves caused revenues to double, triple. We know they didn't cause the entire revenue increase, but economists, if you ask five economists, to what extent was that a Laffer curve response, you'd probably get nine different estimates about to what extent that was driven by this dynamic scoring issue. But what all that really matters is that in terms of the responsibilities as lawmakers, having in mind that when you increase or lower tax rates, especially when you increase or lower tax rates on a group of people that have considerable control over the timing, level, and composition of their income, you are going to get very profound Laffer curve effects. And one of the reasons that I think I'm probably out here is there's a proposal to increase the top tax rate on so-called upper-income taxpayers. Well, one thing, again, that you'll find by looking at the IRS Statistics of Income data, rich people aren't the same as the rest of us, or at least they're not the same as me. Hopefully all of you are rich. But if you look at how rich people get their income, the overwhelming share of their income, depending on whether you're looking at over $1 million, $5 million, $10 million, you're talking two-thirds, 75%, or even more of their income is capital income. In other words, it's investment income, capital gains, interest, dividends. Now, if you're a very wealthy person and you have the ability to hire lots of clever tax accountants, tax lawyers, and tax planners, and your income is in a form where you have tremendous ability about whether or not to even realize a capital gain or not, you have a huge ability to respond or not respond when tax rates change. And that's why the so-called soak the rich taxes, as we sometimes call them in the debate in Washington, tend to be very self-defeating, because rich people are either clever or their financial planners are clever, and they figure out how to adjust their behavior so that they're not paying the taxes. Whereas if some taxes, you don't have those effects. If you increase the payroll tax on a middle-income person, it's not going to have a big effect. I work at the Cato Institute. I get a certain check from the Cato Institute. If my payroll tax goes up or down, or even if my income tax goes up or down, what am I going to do? I don't have nearly the ability to respond to a change in tax policy as a wealthy person has the ability to respond to a change in tax policy. Now, I understand, and I'll go ahead and close on this point here. Trying to put in place a dynamic scoring system for a state is a big challenge, because what are the sensitivities of different taxpayers? What model do you use? You open up a big can of worms. I sometimes think that's a worthwhile endeavor to engage in, and I encourage states to at least explore that. But one thing I think I can say with certainty is that whether or not there actually is a formal dynamic revenue estimating component that is added to a state's revenue forecasting ability, at the very least, policymakers should keep in their mind sort of a rule of thumb notion that when you increase tax rates or lower tax rates, and you're doing that to people who have a lot of sensitivity and ability to change their behavior, you're going to have strong Laffer curve effects. Now, a Laffer curve effect does not mean that tax cuts pay for themselves or that all tax increases lose revenue. All that the Laffer curve means is that there are two moving parts. You, as lawmakers, can change tax rates, but taxpayers can change taxable income. And so often, and this is the problem we have in Washington, they assume two moving parts: tax rates, tax revenue. And that's why our Joint Committee on Taxation gave Senator Packwood that utterly absurd revenue estimate for 100% tax rate. Even if you don't have it as an official mechanism, at least in your own mind, you should understand that there are three moving parts. You can change tax rates. That may change tax revenue. But in between, there's a very important behavioral response by taxpayers. They will change their taxable income or whatever it is that's being taxed, whether it's gasoline, cigarettes, or property, or things like that. And with that, I'll be happy to answer questions. Thank you very much, sir, for the chance to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Mitchell. We'll officially call the meeting to order. We do have a quorum. Representative Mack moves the minutes of March 2nd. Any additions or corrections? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Members, if you would just please take a look in your packet, we do have a revised schedule of, I guess you'd call it deadlines. Just take a look at that if you could. Okay, we're going to go till about 25 minutes to questions for Mr. Mitchell from the committee. Then we're going to go to the Department of Revenue for 10 minutes, and then we're going to open it up the Green Acres debate here. So, Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize, I missed your name.
Dan Mitchell, Cato Institute.
Okay. Mr. Mitchell, thank you for being with us this morning. Can you, and I heard the part I've heard is the concern on what raising the income tax on high earners does. In this committee over the last 4 years, I think we've heard a lot of concern about the concept of, similar along this line. If we would just do dynamic scoring, then tax cuts wouldn't cost money because we could show these secondary effects, and that the net impact, if we could count those in, then we could just do, we could abolish the corporate tax or, cut any myriad of business taxes, and we wouldn't have to account for them. And that would be great. But I think in my review of the data that's out there, both in your organization and looking at what California and Massachusetts have tried and other states that have tried this dynamic scoring, both parties tend to kind of want to make their argument on their side, and they don't want to acknowledge the other, that it's really a taxing and a spending side, and if you do secondary effects on one, you have to do them on the other. And so, my estimation in looking at what Minnesota has available to it and most states is that we just plain old don't have the capacity to do this. The few states that have done it actually, I think, have found out that the effects they thought they would see are nothing like they anticipated. I think the highest was about 18% effect, so that, for example, in a tax cut, you still have the static analysis part of the effect control. It's still about 80%+ of what's static versus dynamic. So you really don't see the tax cuts are free, or you really don't see kind of these big swings that people would like to use dynamic scoring to sort of win the argument. And I think both sides do this. So I guess I would ask you, first of all, how does a state begin to even get the political will if they wanted to do this with a number of things? Minnesota has a balanced budget amendment. So first of all, these scoring things don't really take into effect that we actually have to balance. So that's a big parameter you'd build around an estimate anyhow. But then additionally, most of these effects are 5 and 10 years out. Minnesota is sort of a leader. We have a budget window that we look at of 5 years. Some states look at one. But even in a five-year window, we wouldn't even score any of these effects for a long time. So I think that's a couple things for Minnesota. Balanced budget, how long would we see this stuff outside the window? But the one thing that I'm often concerned that both sides don't want to talk about is that the cost of even some of these tax cuts or tax changes you can lose 30-40% of the benefit through federal deductibility, and states have to care about that. So that's an offsetting thing that we don't see in the models. You know, Minnesota, the deed has a REMI model. It's really not designed to look at taxes. That's not what it does. And so if a state like us wanted to pursue this, can you comment on both sides of the ledger, taxing and spending, and, you know, how would legislators in any state use that information, knowing the effects probably won't show up for many, many years?
Those are all very good points. I mean, it seems like half my time on this issue in Washington is telling Republicans that all tax cuts don't pay for themselves, and is telling Democrats, yes, there is a Laffer curve. It seems like I don't have any friends at all. You're definitely right that the effects are in the long run, and that, of course, complicates matters for state lawmakers if you have balanced budget rules of some sort, which 49 of the 50 states do. But even a small dynamic effect, 18% or something like that, when you expand it over time with compounding, becomes very significant. I oftentimes tell lawmakers in Washington, if you do something that's going to increase economic growth by 0.2% and you're planning on dying next year, you might as well not do it. But by the time you get 20 or 25 years out, the average income for someone in America is going to be $4,000 to $5,000 higher. Now, you know, so you have a challenge. You're boxed in by one-year budget windows. You might want to do a tax policy change that'll be good for Minnesota's economy over 10, 20 years. But if you're not allowed to capture any of that expected value, if you were doing accrual budgeting, you know, perhaps you could factor that in. And then, of course, you get to the whole issue that if you did do it, you'll have 15 different models with 15 different approaches, which is why I said that ultimately what I think is important is for every lawmaker to at least have a common sense rule of thumb in their head when they're considering, okay, if we are going to cut taxes, which tax should we cut that gives us the most bang for the buck? And those tend to be lowering marginal tax rates that are high, which could be high-income people, but they could also be low-income people that have implicit high marginal tax rates because of the withdrawal of government benefits. And if you're going to raise taxes, likewise, you should try to figure out, you know, some tax increases do a lot of damage, some tax increases do relatively small amounts of damage. So, you know, whatever your approach is, just use the common sense rule of thumb, even if it's a bridge too far to try to put in a whole dynamic revenue estimating model in your process here in the state.
Representative Lynch, just a quick follow-up, then we've got about 2 minutes just left here. I want to get to Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. If you could just answer the part on federal deductibility. I don't know if you, for states, you know, this is unlike Congress. When we give a dollar in a tax cut to somebody right off the top, it's very inefficient delivery. We're losing a lot of money to Congress, so we're basically, you know, giving Congress a windfall and hurting our state. Can you comment about, you know, how would folks model in the loss to federal the loss that states have due to federal deductibility?
Mr. Mitchell.
Federal deductibility does mute the impact of changes on the state level. I strongly suspect, though, given what's happening in Washington, that sooner or later there's going to be there already is through the AMT, but sooner or later there's going to be additional pressure on state deductibility. I wouldn't be surprised 5 or 10 years from now to see that either gone or sharply curtailed, maybe limited to a 15% rate. It's not going to stay around very long.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to the testifier. Just related to this subject is something that I'm concerned about, related to static and dynamic scoring, and that is the issue of volatility.
Of what?
Volatility. Okay. In the sense that when you consolidate and you centralize the tax code on a small group of people, when you concentrate tax increases on savings and investment, and traditionally, you know, by implementing anti-growth, anti-jobs initiatives, that it becomes increasingly difficult to score those things because there is such crazy volatility in the tax code. And I'm just wondering if you could talk about, with regards to the dynamic scoring, you know, when you have a one half of or 5% of taxpayers paying a significantly higher tax rate, how do you score that with regards to volatility? Because there is such a small number of people who can have such a broad range of behaviors to impact those numbers.
Mr. Mitchell?
This is called the California effect sometimes in the Washington debate, but it's also the Washington effect. One of the reasons why we have a big deficit is because tax revenues fell off the cliff with the financial crisis and the downturn. Why did they fall off the cliff? They fell off the cliff because we have the top 10% paying about two-thirds of the income tax burden, and those people overwhelmingly, as I said before, get a lot of their income from capital. And so if interest, dividends, and capital gains are all falling, the government, in effect, has a very unstable revenue source. It's called the California effect because California is just this way, but more so, especially when you factor in state migration. Many, many of the wealthy people in California have redomiciled to Nevada, which is a zero-income tax state. So you have the combination of what's happening with the national economy causing a lot of instability with California's fiscal policy, but then it's compounded by the fact that, you know, this isn't, you know, there's no Berlin Wall. You don't have to tunnel out under the border of Nevada. And so California has wound up driving a lot of its high-income taxpayers out of the state. In some cases, they're not actually leaving the state, but they've somehow arranged their affairs so they spend, like, less than 180 days in the state and things like that. So it's probably a case where you actually do have, it could be one of those rare cases where tax increases actually might lose revenue if they're concentrated on this very volatile, unstable source of revenue.
Okay, thank you. With that, we're going to go to the department. And Mr. Mitchell, how long are you be in our great state?
I am leaving early this afternoon, so...
I hope it's nothing I said.
No, nothing you said. It's a little chillier than I'm used to, but...
Okay,
I appreciate
because
the chance
members,
to be
and I've cut some members off here, and I apologize for that, but we were on a really tight schedule today. So would you be able to stay, like, after we adjourn at noon, after we voted on the Green Acres bill?
No, I'm meeting a journalist in Minneapolis at noon, your staffer will have my, I'll make sure he has my email address. He'll also have my formal testimony, which I just excerpted a few things from. And I'm more than happy to answer phone calls, emails, whatever. This is a...
Okay, well, we'll do, Mr. Mitchell. Thank you for your presentation. What we'll do is we will get the information, or we already have the information, apparently. We'll get that out to members. If you have questions of Mr. Mitchell, please feel free to call him or email him. And I thank you so much. Department of Revenue, please. And then at a quarter to, we're going to have an overview on some Green Acres issues, and then we're going to be taking the Green Acres bill up, and then we're going to be voting on it by noon. Okay, Department of Revenue. And thank you very much, Mr. Mitchell. Okay, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is John Hagan. I'm director of the Property Tax Division of the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And,
okay, hold on here a second. Oh, should we
maybe take some more questions from Mr. Mitchell? Until quarter two.
Let's do this. Mr. Mitchell, if you could step back to the table. We were going to have the Department of Revenue respond to the dynamic modeling. Apparently, they were going to pass on that, which is fine. And then we'll get in the Green Acres at a quarter, too. So, Mr. Mitchell, Representative Groffalo, did you have a follow-up? And if not, we'll go to Representative Downey.
Well, no, Mr. Chairman, I was just going to say, you know, I'm going to exceed my quota on pop culture references for the day with this one, but just to reinforce the testifier's point is that, you know, it's called the Tiger Woods effect. Now, I'm talking about tax code and accounting, nothing else here. He, you know, he grew up in California, and the weather's really nice in California, and he makes a lot of money. Where does Tiger Woods live?
Florida.
He lives in Florida. So there is an absolute, not just anecdotal, but from a policy perspective, what's happened in California is a perfect example of what can go wrong. For the first time since the state of California, you know, existed in this last census data, they did not add a congressional seat. And for the first time in the state's history. And so in a place that is having, you know, huge growth, has all the advantages of weather, climate, access to ports, every geographical possible benefit you could have, but California is not growing. And so I think it's generally accepted that, and with regards going back to my original point on volatility, that it creates this erratic situation. And I think I haven't actually heard the term California effect, but I think I'm going to start using it, that I agree with that 100%. So thank you to the testifier for his testimony today.
Bruce M. Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. I just wanted to make the point. I think the assertion, or at least the implication of the assertion, is that some of us have suggested that we use dynamic scoring for our budgeting, and I don't think that's it at all. It might be really helpful in certain bills and proposals to look at a dynamic scoring. I actually appreciate the more conservative nature of our budgeting constraints. But it is really important to note the difference between the federal government and state governments. Because we have a balanced budget requirement, we, of necessity, when we want to increase spending, have to extract that revenue from the private sector. And so every time we make a spending decision, we have to evaluate the opportunity cost of what might happen or would happen with that money if it were left in the public sector, in the private sector. At the federal level, we can print money or we can go out and borrow. And so the payback is spread out over a longer period of time. And so the quote-unquote jobs impact or the positive economic benefit of borrowing at the federal level looks really good in the short term, but when the credit cards come due, it's not nearly so good. And so we keep piling up this kind of negative economic impact over time at the federal level. It's immediate at the state level, and that's why I think it's really important every time we talk about these bills to think about what is the opportunity cost in the private sector as compared to the public purposes for the spending that we might have. So I think that's really the crux of the argument as compared to suggesting that we should be using dynamic scoring.
Thank you, Representative Downey. Other questions for Mr. Mitchell? Representative Dabney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And there's, we seem to be talking about three different things, but we're actually, I think, only talking about two of them. One is taxes and their impact on the economy, which you haven't talked about, but you've talked about taxes. The other is the value of public goods. And that is a piece that has been largely missing from this committee's debate, that, you know, when we purchase government services, when we build roads, when we do things like that, what is the value of that to the public or to the private sector? And we don't talk about that, and it might be interesting at another time. I won't threaten the department with a conversation about it now, to talk about how do they value public good. Because we are the only ones who can provide public goods. And then job growth. And we seem to be saying, well, lower tax rates, higher job growth. But in fact, in the Reagan years, that's not what happened. He tripled the national debt. Unemployment remained high. Productivity lagged. And it wasn't until the mid-1990s, under a different president with a different tax policy, that we actually saw the economic growth. So I think we need to get all the pieces on the table, because if we're thinking that lower tax rates creates jobs, that's not the experience of the Reagan years. Thank you.
Mr. Mitchell, to that comment?
If you look at the big models that look at all public policies and economic growth, I'm thinking like the Economic Freedom of the World Index, the Index of Economic Freedom, the Global Economic Forum's World Competitiveness Report. They're all very similar, and they all identify things like rule of law, property rights, sound money, openness to trade, fiscal policy, regulatory policy. And what you will find is that fiscal policy is only about 20% of a nation's grade. And of course, I don't know if they actually do it this way, but presumably fiscal policy is probably half tax, half spending. So tax policy, in terms of an economic climate for any jurisdiction, might be only 10%. And the example that I use when I talk about this to people is Ukraine. Nobody wants to invest money in Ukraine. They have a crummy economic climate. But the one good thing they have, at least from my perspective, is they have a 15% flat tax. And that actually has led to some Laffer curve effects and some positive responses. But if you have a choice between investing in Ukraine with a 15% flat tax and investing in Sweden with a top tax rate of, I think, 57%, you're probably still going to choose Sweden, because in the overall economic freedom rankings, Sweden is about 20th in the world and Ukraine's 115th or so. So, yes, taxes matter, but I think there might be, I sense we might not share a lot of views, but we would both agree that there's all sorts of different factors that determine economic performance, and even public goods. A lot of the economic research shows that some things governments do, such as providing the rule of law, the property rights, the sound institutional framework, can be good for growth. But then you get into much different debates when you're looking at transfer and consumption spending, where a lot of the academic research indicates that you are diverting resources from a more productive private sector. But yes, taxes are just one piece of the puzzle. But if it's the tax committee, that's probably the puzzle piece you care about.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mitchell. We'll stop there, and we'll now go to the department. Thank you very much
for
your presentation and answering the questions of members. We'll now go to the department, and then members, we've got some amendments. We're going to have a bill before us, and then we will be voting on this at 12 o'clock.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lincheski.
Mr. Chair, I know you're trying to take a vote by noon. Are we going to discuss this today?
I just said that it's in the packets.
Okay. I know you had mentioned yesterday you wanted to discuss it, and then we were waiting until today. So
yes.
Okay. Because some of the deadlines are today, so I'm hoping we're going to discuss it.
Let's do it right now.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just I noticed that in the very first couple of things here, there's some language about deadlines to let the committee administrator know that you wish something was in a report, the division report of the full bill. And, I guess I'd just like some clarification. We assume that just a hearing request means you'd like your bill heard and in the bill, in the omnibus bill. Are you asking for a new process where we actually write something out, or we all go talk to Mr. Patrick, or does the hearing request meet that requirement?
Yes, it does.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chair, can I just ask then, it looks like we're kind of done in this committee on March 21st this year, and I imagine
you might... Chesky, we're just getting going on March 21st.
Okay. So should we view that as that the bills that are continuing to be introduced after March 21st and taxes are still in play for hearings and for another...
Absolutely.
So you think there'll be more than one omnibus tax bill?
Might be about five.
Really? So are you saying your first one you know isn't going anywhere?
Well, we could all be surprised, and if he'd signed that one, then we'll continue work on tax policy and give him another one. If we're on a roll, we're on a roll.
Okay. Well, it's important, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that for members to understand, because we now have lots of members who are drafting bills today to get them in the hopper tomorrow, to get included in your omnibus tax bill. So I appreciate that. And just finally, I'm wondering, there's a lot of revenue raiser bills out there, as we've talked about yesterday, you and I still floating around, and I've talked with Mr. Patrick. We've got all these members who are raising fees and doing other sorts of revenue. Will we be ensured they're all going to get herded back here before the omnibus tax bill is put together?
Yes, and I believe SASH has been provided with a list of the bills we found, and if you find some above beyond that, let me know.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair, and I'm a little confused too. In person, I'm always confused, but this is my 25th year at the Capitol, and I always, for fiscal bills in the past,
it meant that it was a deadline. Usually, tax fiscal bill was after that. And what I have on my calendar is the 25th is the first fiscal bill deadline, so this isn't a fiscal committee, or is this still a deadline for us for a bill that doesn't have anything to do with local or sales tax issue?
Well, that Representative Rukavina, that is our deadline for the omnibus tax bill. But
so,
it's different than we've done in the past. That's correct.
So, Mr. Chair, if I have some, I got a call yesterday from a city in my district that has a kind of a peculiar problem that probably is unique to them, entering into an agreement with another community in an annexation and committing themselves to giving them X percent in growth over there, I think over like a 20-year period, so they didn't end up in court. And they're worried about levy limits, and I don't know if there's going to be levy limits or what. And so is that a local issue, or is that something I can do as an amendment and address it here in the final, as we're putting the tax bill together before the 25th of March?
Well,
do I have to get a bill in, or cause I don't even know.
Representative Rukavina, before the 25th, and as the bill goes through the committee, there we will be looking at amendments. So that's one possibility you would have to go, with the amendment.
Mr. Chair, we always have like a mining tax bill. I'm assuming that's a general tax, and even though it's a kind of in lieu of property tax thing, so is that coming here, or do I have to have a bill in by today to get a house file number by Monday to go to local taxes division, even though it's...
See, Representative Rukavina, if you could possibly get tax committee administrator some language, that's kind of the purpose of this, because we realize that not everybody's going to be able to get all the bills in that they need this quickly. And so we're going with the dates that we've been given, trying to do the best job working with Representative Lincheski to make sure that fiscal staff and House research can work on getting amendments put together in time. I think we went to, what, a three-day period when you're going to be able to do that. So, Representative Brukovina, we will work with you on those things and try to be very flexible on those issues. And
thank
so, and I really do believe that there'll be several omnibus tax bills.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
As former Governor Plenty used to say, as Majority Leader, the situation is fluid.
Well, Mr. Chair, I know you have done your best work with amendments, and so have I. So, you know, I mean.
And I learned from a great one.
Yeah.
Yes.
Just go on.
Representative Kahn. And Rukavina. Yeah. Okay, Representative Lincheski.
Yes.
Okay, we will now go. We're going to, since we did need to have that discussion, I appreciate that, Representative Lincheski. We will go till about 11 with the department, and then we will stop there, and then we will bring up Representative Lemire, and we will take a look at the Green Acres bill. So if you could give us some background, please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is John Hagan. I'm Director of the Property Tax Division of the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And with me today is Andrea Fish. In the interest of time, instead of trying to coordinate my mind and my finger, she'll click through the presentation, and I'll see how fast I can talk.
Mr. Hagan, Andrea was
Fish.
F-I-S-H. Okay, thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here to try to recount some of the history of the Green Acres, where we've been, where we are, and some of the changes that have taken place. To begin with, my favorite slide of the whole works, and it seems as though the Green Acres program has been fraught with controversy throughout its entire history. Once upon a time, a bill was quietly passed which affected some farmers, some properties. It was tucked away in an omnibus tax bill, created confusion, was difficult for taxpayers and tax administrators to understand. Of course, you know what I'm alluding to. It was the original 1967 Green Acres tax bill, and that's a quote directly from the Hatfield Commission report in 1970. The Green Acres provisions were developed in 1967. The original bill deferred special assessments of the property. It required a property to be 10 contiguous acres. It had to be actively, exclusively used for farm purposes. It had to be homestead or contiguous to the homestead of a property owner. And it also required an income threshold of $750 for the farm plus a minimum of $25 per tillable acre. In 1969, the first tinkering with the Green Acres law occurred, and the homestead requirement was expanded to include property that was owned continuously for seven or more years. A prohibition was added that precluded lakeshore property or property within 20 rods of a lakeshore from being included within Green Acres. And the income requirements were changed. They were actually reduced. They were reduced from the $750 to $300 and from $25 per tillable acres to $10 per tillable acre. And those changes have remained until 2008. They added the potential for horticultural nursery stock. They added sloughs, wastelands, other types of properties. In 1970, the first extensive report on Green Acres was the Hatfield Report, and that report actually urged a full repeal of the Green Acres provisions. They determined that it caused unfair tax burdens to the public. The benefit was not equal to the benefit to the public. The program was not restricted to bona fide farmers. The land that could not be farmed, swamps, sloughs, etc., were included, and the tax shift they anticipated would become substantial over time. Some minor changes were made in 1970s. They added the potential for family farm corporations to the Green Acres law. The income, they established the potential to value the farmland for Green Acres purposes based on rental rates and income. That proposal was repealed a few years later because they thought it did not accurately reflect the value of farmland and was not a good measure of valuing farmland. It was returned to the market value concept. The prohibition prohibiting Green Acres within 20 rods of a lakeshore was eliminated so that Green Acres could, in fact, abut lakeshore property. In 1978, a second research report was created, and that was done by the House Research Division, or House Research. They identified a number of problems with the program, too. They felt there was an apparent inequity in the treatment of different taxpayers. They concluded that although the law provides tax relief for farmers, it had done little to stem urban sprawl. The report concluded that the commitment was too minimal compared to the benefits, and the statute was too broad, and that it allowed hobby farms, estates, things like that, to receive the Green Acres benefit, and extended relief to persons with high incomes without any type of a means test for need or ability to pay. The report recommends that the legislature should address and clarify some of the program's purposes. What was the purpose of the program to provide tax relief or to preserve farmland? The report concluded the law cannot fulfill the two divergent functions. In 1980, some more law changes were made. The non-contiguous properties were added to allow green acres within two townships of the property, which would parallel the agricultural classification. They inserted income requirements for nurseries and greenhouses. They required nurseries to qualify for green acres to have 80% or more of their retail or wholesale sales from the sale of horticultural or nursery stock. Something of a major change was made in 1997 when the primary use requirement was added to the green acres provision. It required that to qualify for green acres, it had to be primarily used for farm purposes. At the same time, that same requirement was removed from the ag classification, so it made it easier to get into the ag classification. Basically, all you needed at that point to get an ag class was 10 or more acres in production. But to be qualified for green acres, to qualify, you had to be primarily devoted to farm purposes, which raised the level much higher for the green acres properties. In 2006, the Department of Revenue, at the request of the legislature, conducted a third study for green acres and how it was working. It was a little more guarded than some of the earlier reports, but we found some problems with the green acres program. We concluded that many small suburban hobby farms benefit because of the small acreage requirements and the minimum income requirements at the time of the $10 per tillable acre. It's interesting to note the initial income limits, as I mentioned, were established in 1967. They were reduced in 1969. I know this group, when Representative Abrams was the chair, tried a number of times to raise the income limits, but is unsuccessful doing that because to raise them to a meaningful level from parts of the state, it made it so high that other parts of the state would not qualify. If you lowered it, it made everybody qualify. So that wasn't particularly successful. We concluded that the purpose of the program was not clear, and if agricultural preservation is intended, it should be specified and clarified. In 2008, the legislative auditors conducted a very thorough and excellent report of the Green Acres program, and they conclude that the program helps to slow the rate of development but does not assure a long-term preservation of the land. The program reduced properties for enrolled landowners, but it did not. There was a resulting tax shift on other property owners. And they conclude the tax benefit from the program paying back 3 years' worth of deferred taxes was very small relative to the benefits and the tax savings to the property owners. And finally, they conclude that land not used for agricultural purposes was benefiting from the program. In 2008, it was sort of a culmination of a lot of things. It was a culmination of a lot of taxpayer complaints. The legislature was dealing on an ongoing basis with taxpayer complaints from some counties who did not allow green acres. I know of one county that had a resolution adopted by the county board that prohibited green acres. Some counties gave green acres to everybody. So it was essentially the Wild West where green acres were being implemented differently throughout the state. That created problems with sales ratio studies and trying to separate agricultural lands from recreational lands for sales purposes. And there was, because of the rapid escalation in rural vacant lands, the woodlands with people, that took place in the late 90s and early 2000s. The threat of lands going to green acres, the whole north half of the state going to green acres, was very imminent, which would have resulted in a huge tax shift onto homeowners and commercial properties. The legislative auditor's report was another factor that added into a number of the changes of the law. So all these factors combined, the complaints from property owners and legislative auditor's report and all the other reports, precipitated a lot of changes that were made in the 2008 legislative session. The 2008 changes separated farms into two classes, or it separated the land into two classes, 2A and 2B. Class 2A is agricultural land, 2B is non-productive land, or excuse me, is rural vacant land that is part of a farm. The 2008 provided for impractical to separate that was somewhat narrowly defined for lands that were interspersed within the land, 2B acres that were interspersed with the 2A and the agricultural properties. It clarified that only 2A lands would qualify for green acres going forward, and other lands not enrolled in the green acres, the 2B lands, would no longer qualify, and there would be a 7-year payback associated with them. It also codified the valuation methodology that the Department of Revenue was utilizing, and for the department to assign values to various counties to identify the actual farm value. The 2008 changes, I would think, and most of you would probably agree, caused a great deal of confusion. The Department of Revenue probably was inadvertently a part of that. In an effort to get a lot of information out and try to educate the property tax administrators, we sent out volumes of information trying to make property tax administrators aware of the changes caused by the 2008 law changes. And I think, I'm certain, the result of that was information overload, which gave the tax administrators way too much information to assimilate in a short period of time. And the resulting information that went to some taxpayers was equally confusing. I believe that if you look back in retrospect, the seven-year clawback was probably overly aggressive, and it created a great deal of consternation, angst, and pushback from the property owners on the 2B property lands. Removing the lands from 2B, the 2B lands from Green Acres without giving it a landing place or a place to go, likely it created a lot of problems too, and likely in retrospect was not a good idea. In 2009, a lot of these issues were readdressed. The legislature met again and resolved a lot of the problems that had created the firestorm in 2008. The clarification was added to the impractical to separate, and it was expanded to allow for lands that were interspersed or lands that did not have the potential to qualify for Green Acres, ravines, rivers, streams, things of that nature. They also created a rural preserve program, which was more or less a landing place for the lands that did not qualify for the Green Acres. Rural preserve essentially mimics Green Acres. It allows the property to defer the highest, same separation between the highest and best use value and the actual lower value. And it was result largely of a lot of taxpayer testimony about the need to keep these lands green as part of the agricultural property. The requirements were that 10 or more acres, like Green Acres, were required to qualify. It applied to lands that were part of an agricultural homestead or that were in Green Acres that no longer qualified, the 2B lands, essentially. There were some conditions of it. There was a requirement that the land have to have a conservation management plan or a conservation assessment plan. This was developed, the expectation was that the soil and water conservation districts would develop the plan for the farmers. It also required a recorded covenant that would encumber the land for a period of not less than 8 years, that the property owners would have to fulfill certain requirements. They'd have to remove invasive species and control noxious weeds, and they had to be in for a minimum of 5 years, after which they could make application to get out, and then they would be out in 3 years, for a total of 8 years. And once they were out, they could not get back in for a period of 3 years. essentially, that's where we're at now. The requirement is for 10 acres used for agricultural purposes is still ag land. It also still requires the same requirement for Green Acres. That requirement has never changed, I might add. Primarily devoted to was added in 1997, which increased the requirements for Green Acres and lessens the requirements for agricultural lands. Only 2B acres, or excuse me, only 2A acres now qualify for Green Acres. There were, with all the negative comments and a lot of the concerns, and I reiterate that the 2008, the seven-year clawback, some of those things precipitated an awful lot of public anger. There were some real positive results from the changes, too. I think the separating land from 2A to 2B had some very positive sales ratio implications. It made the assessment much, much better and made the quality of assessment much better, and I think most assessors would agree to that. The class rate was reduced from 0.55 to 0.50 in 2009, I believe, which is a significant increase, significant decrease. And the rural vacant land now is eligible for a property for a valuation program that is very, very similar to the Green Acres program. Representative Lemire's bill today even makes it more similar and enhances a lot of the provisions. Do you want me to talk about tax increase, or should I?
Let's go to the bill itself. Okay. You'll be here for, we can refer to you for questions as we move forward with the bill, but thank you very much for your presentation. I will move, Representative Lemire, if you could please come to the table. And members, I will move House File 12. Be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Ways and Means. Members will be working off the first committee engrossment that we have before us. Representative Lemire, welcome to the committee. Did you have any amendments you needed moved to get the bill in the shape you'd like? Is the 822 amendment yours?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I'll move that.
Representative Erickson moves the H0012A22 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have the bill in the shape the author would like. We're going to have a brief presentation from the author of the bill, And then we will take some limited testimony from people for and against. I just need to kind of get a sense of where I'm at here. How many people wish to testify against House File 12 as amended? Against the bill? Oh, wow. Maybe we can bring Mr. Mitchell back for some more questions.
So, Mr. Chair, someone moved the bill then as amended to
yes,
be before
I
us.
Moved the bill before us to go to Ways and Means. How many people wish to testify on behalf of the bill? Okay, we have several people we'll hear from that wish to testify. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have an amendment when it's appropriate.
Yes, and thank you, Representative Loeffler. Members, it's my intention to have a presentation from the author on the bill as amended. Then there's no one against it, so that means we will take testimony from the people that are for it. That means very brief testimony because nobody's against it. And then we will have amendments from whoever, whatever members have amendments, and we'll discuss those. And again, it'll be my intention to vote on this bill at 12 o'clock or before. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you could please present your bill to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Should I go over the description of the amendment first, or should I?
Why don't you just go through the presentation that the amendment is now in the bill, so you can just include it in your description of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 12 first started off as a full repeal of the Green Acres program, but through our agricultural committee, we had testifiers from the departments, assessing officers, the farm organizations, farmers, and we determined that that wasn't the correct place to go at this time. Wasn't the correct place to go. If we wanted to continue with this legislation that we last decades instead of going from year to year, we held multiple work sessions, multiple committee hearings, and House File 12 was passed unanimously out of the Agriculture Committee. House File 12 modifies the Rural Preserve Program by eliminating the requirements for a conservation plan and it removes the 8-year covenant agreement. It provides that property enrolled in the Green Acres Program or the Rural Preserve Program after May 1st, 2012 will be subject to a 5-year clawback instead of a 3-year clawback. House File 12 also allows land removed from Green Acres after the 2008 changes to be reinstated to the Green Acres Program or the Rural Preserve Program at the owner's request, and it requires the Commissioner of Revenue to consider alternative methodologies for valuing the property in both programs. Mr. Chair, we also added a purpose to the legislation, and the purpose states, the legislature finds that it is in the interest of the state to encourage and preserve farms by mitigating the property tax impact of increasing land values due to non-agricultural economic forces. This is pretty much the gist of the bill, and if I could have my testifiers come up.
Okay, thank you, Representative. I saw three hands, I believe. Why don't we just get all three of you down around Representative Lemire here. I think there's three chairs there. I see Mr. Tom Peterson from Farmers Union, Mr. Chris Raddatz from the Farm Bureau, and someone else. Let's start with someone else. If you can please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Gloria Pinky, and I'm a manager in Dakota County Assessor's Office, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, members, and thank you, Representative Lemire, for allowing assessors to be a part of coming together on this bill. It was a pleasure to be part of the Agricultural Committee and work through some of the bugs that have been involved in the Green Acre process over the last several years. And on behalf of the Assessing Association, we're very pleased with the track that this bill has now taken and encourage your support and passing of it. And time is of the essence. In order to administer the bill, the faster this body and your counterparts in the Senate can come to an agreement and get something passed, the more time we as administrators will have to explain to the public the benefits, the changes, and get people back on straight line. Thank you. That's all I have to say. We're in support of the bill.
Okay. I think what we'll do is we'll take the three testifiers, then we'll open up for a few minutes of questions. Mr. Raddatz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Committee. I'm Chris Raddatz, Director of Public Policy for Minnesota Farm Bureau. And just briefly, why are we here today? Before 2008, and I'm not talking about the hobby farmers today, I'm talking about the farmers that are farming larger tracts of land and actually farming for a living. So they had 100 acres of land, let's say, and there was maybe some non-productive land as a part of it. Well, prior to 2008, that was eligible for green acres. Then with the changes that were made with 2008, with the development of the Class 2B classification, now all of a sudden, maybe a fourth of their land no longer qualifies for green acres. They didn't do anything different. They aren't farming it anything differently. There's been no sale. But because of those actions, a piece of that land was no longer eligible for green acres. That caused their property tax values to increase, forcing that other productive piece of that farm to have to pay a higher property tax, making it more difficult for that farming operation to make a profit. The changes we have here today get us back closer to where we were in 2008. We support them, and I would support Ms. Pinky's comments that this round we've worked with revenue, we've worked with assessors. Previously, legislators passed legislation. The intent was there, but it didn't always follow through the process. This time, we said, okay, if we do this in law, how is revenue going to interpret it? How are assessors going to do it on the ground? And we've had those discussions now, so I think we'll avoid a lot of the problems we had in the past. Appreciate your support and passage of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Raddatz. Mr. Peterson, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, and then we'll go into some member questions.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union. We also support House File 12, and I'll just echo the comments. I really thought we had a good process in the Agriculture Committee and a bill that passed out of the committee with bipartisan support. The farmers that I represent had the same similar concerns that Mr. Raddatz stated with the covenant and with the conservation plan and going forward. This bill does get us closer back to, I think, Mr. Chairman, what you've heard and other people have heard in their districts, that a farm is a farm, and this will get us back closer to that. And I appreciate and encourage your support again for our farmers that are trying to make a living out there on the farm. This program does help them quite a bit. Thank you.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll direct this question to Representative Lemire. Representative Lemire, I understand that in this process, and perhaps the others can comment on this as well, we had ag landowners involved in this discussion too, correct, in the creation of this
Lemire.
Bill?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Representative Gottwald?
No, that's good.
Okay. Okay, if there's no other questions, we will go to amendments. if we could get the amendments, how many amendments do we have? Representative Loeffler, are there others other than Representative Loeffler? Okay, if the pages could please hand out that Representative Lincheski, and then Representative Lincheski has one. So if you please, we'll work on the Loeffler amendment first. If you could start describing it as the amendment cast out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Well, it's being crossed out. I'll say that my intent is not to do away with the Green Acres or the Rural Preserve Program in any way, and it doesn't. The amendment does is it simply reinstates the conservation plan, which we were told in the property tax division is typically 1 to 4 pages of how you're going to take care of the non-tillable land, which is your wetlands, your lakeshore, your forest tracts that you're not actively engaged in agriculture in, and that it restores the 8-year covenant. And what we heard is that this the way Green Acres works is it shifts property tax burdens onto other people in the same community. About $35 million throughout the whole state of Minnesota shifts back and forth. And I always feel like when we're going to ask someone else to pick up a portion of someone else's property tax burden, there ought to be a public benefit that we can clearly define and explain to people who aren't farmers in that particular community or in that county or elsewhere in the state. And I think that
Excuse me, Representative Loeffler. I'm sorry, you still have the floor, but Representative Loeffler moves the H0012823 amendment. Excuse me, we should have done that first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just thought everyone should have it before I moved it.
Thank you.
While I think I may need some advice from staff on how to adjust line 1.3, because it would reinstate lines 1.1 to 1.17 on the A22 amendment that we just adopted. The effect is the same, but I'm just not sure how that gets drafted, and I know our staff will take care of that.
Mr. Michael? Or Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chairman, I think that we can make, if the amendment's adopted, we'll make the appropriate adjustments to the language so that it'll fit correctly in the amended version of the bill.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you. I just wanted to make sure that that adjustment got made.
Thank you.
And so, as I said, this deals with what is the benefit to the other tax, the public benefit for giving a tax break to this particular type of business, and it relates to the ag preserve land. And what we had, I think, was a really nice, elegant compromise that was worked out, which is you get the same benefits for your non-tillable, green, your wetlands, your lakeshore, your woodlot, as was provided in the past, but you have to file a conservation plan, which basically says, I'm going to take care of that. And it, there isn't much requirement. You just have to file a plan. It doesn't have a lot of strings. We were told it's 1 to 4 pages. And that you sign a covenant that you're going to preserve that as the green space that earns this special tax benefit. As you saw from Mr. Hagan's going through the history over and over and over again, the concern was that the commitment was too small for the benefit received. And this just restores that 1 to 4 page conservation covenant commitment and the covenant that you'll honor your conservation plan for the non-tillable area land. This does not have anything to do with the agricultural use land. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to answer questions.
Okay. First of all, I would go to the author of the bill for comments on the A23 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In our Agriculture Committee, that's how we got to the five-year. Members on the Democratic Farmer Labor Party wanted a more restrictive requirement on our farmers, and the members of the Republican Party wanted a less restrictive requirement on the farmers, and that's where we got to the 5 years, because we wanted this to be a bipartisan bill. The 8-year covenant, it takes you 3 years. Once you decide you want to get out, it takes you 3 more years to get out of this covenant, and to have farmers do a conservation assessment on their property. There are original conservationists, and I think it's I recommend the board vote no on this amendment.
Representative Gottwald.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, I would point out I've actually had to deal with a couple of my constituents on these exact decisions about what they would do under the new rules, and I'll ignore the whole issue about the tax impacts to some of these people, but conservation plans don't happen by themselves either. You have to actually have people come in and do them. There's expenses involved in doing that, and I think Representative Lemire just pointed out the time impact as well. So I don't know, members can do what they want, but I would be inclined to keep the language in the bill and vote no on this amendment.
Senator Sikowski, then Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lemire, thank you for coming with this bill, and I really like the language you're bringing. Members, I'm opposed to the amendment. As a matter of fact, this exact part of the bill is the part that we definitely need to strike, because it's the part that is prohibiting, at least in Winona County, which half of which I represent. I understand that none of the landowners that have taken up these changes or the new program that was offered by the latest version here, and the impediment there was exactly that, $800 or $1,000 for many farms to do this conservation plan, of which there's really no understanding or conformity among the various agencies that can write these things. So it's very unworkable. Your bill corrects it very nice, Representative Lemire. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Lincheski, and then we'll take a vote on the amendment, and then go back to the author. Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to this amendment, I strongly urge a yes vote. We just heard from the Department of Revenue in one of their slides talked about that the Office of the Legislative Auditor said that one of the big problems with this program was that it's not doing much to preserve. And this amendment, in fact, ensures that. And I heard Representative Gottwald. And he just gave me the little money sign, and that's what I was going to say. He's talking about the money and the burden and the timeline and the paperwork, and I understand that too. It pales in comparison to the other folks who reside in your district who are paying their taxes for them. That's what this bill does. It lets the residents of a community pay the farmers' property taxes. So I think what Representative Loeffler is saying here, and members, we have green acres across the whole state. If you're going to shift, this isn't the state picking up the property taxes. I think a lot of the, you know, I think legislators who want to change this stuff, it would be a little more legitimate to say, let's have a new program where the state's going to pay the farmers' property taxes. And we'd actually, because it would cost us money to take that boat here, we might have a little more courage around this issue. What Green Acres does is says the folks who live in your district who don't have a farm are going to pay the farmers' property taxes. That's what it does. It shifts those property taxes on to the other people who reside there. So what Representative Loeffler is saying, hey, I'm not even trying to stop making other people pay the farmers' property taxes for them. I'd just like to know you're actually going to conserve the land, and it might cost you a little to prepare that plan, and it might be some hassle and some paperwork, but their next-door neighbors down the road are paying their property taxes for them, and I just don't think it's asking that much. This is still going to be that the farmers are getting the assistance of all their neighbors and everybody who lives in town and who doesn't own a farm. Even in the district in Minnesota that has the absolute most owners of green acres, I think that district is about 1,800 property owners, and I think we all represent about 40,000 people. So, or, you know, some are less, some are higher, and that'll change again. So you can see that there isn't a single legislator in the state of Minnesota who isn't asking the majority of their constituents to pay some other portion of their constituents' property taxes. All Representative Loeffler is asking is that when you ask those other people to pick up their property taxes, that they will have to file a conservation plan. And, in fact, this designation is called Rural Preserve. That's what it's called. The goal here is to preserve the land. So I think it's a pretty simple amendment that you're asking your other folks who are going to pay your residents, who are going to pay their property taxes, to just know that the plan is going to be in a very short conservation plan. And even after the limited clawback, when they sell the land, that money, that's still an incredibly good deal for the farmer.
Representative Gottwald.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lincheski, you know, we use this a lot in committee about the whole idea of a virtual tax shift. Let's be clear. What Green Acres is about is identifying a set of land and identifying what parts of it are unproductive. I mean, there are portions of these farms where they have to farm around. This is unusable land. It is invalid. It doesn't have a lot of value to the farmer at all. It can't be sold separately because it's in the middle of the farm or around the edges of the farm, and it is less valuable land to them. So they are paying less taxes on it. That's what Green Acres is designed to do. That makes sense. And what it means is that the total area or community doesn't have as much taxes. I grant you that. But the idea that that means there's a literal tax shift is not necessarily true. That portion of their land is, in fact, less valuable. So the community itself has less taxes. Now, the conservation program under Representative Loeffler's amendment costs money to do, and I've worked with some of my own constituents on this. They end up spending a lot of money on land that is virtually, you know, worthless to them for the purposes of generating wealth on their farm or utilizing it for its ag purpose. This is unproductive land. It is in conservation by the very nature of the fact that it sits there on the farm and they don't use it for anything else. But now they're being asked to bring in a forester or somebody, well, forester for the forestry programs. But now you got to bring in somebody to do this plan, pay them a bunch of money, and the benefit of treating this as unproductive land is almost lost as a result of it. So why do we want to add that? You know, the only reason you would do that is if you assume the cost-benefit analysis justifies it. And it doesn't. This is less valuable land. It's unproductive land. They're being credited for that under the Green Acres program. And, you know, we could go on and on about different parts of properties and communities that get lower taxes or higher based on their valuation. And then because one gets less than the other one, that's a cost shift to the other property owners. I mean, let's be honest about it. Green Acres was meant to address that issue. A lot of farmers in my district have that problem and that concern, and adding the conservation piece is just adding cost where we had originally intended to credit them for unproductive land.
Is there anyone that doesn't know how they're going to vote on this amendment? Representative Lincheski, then Loeffler, then we're going to vote. Representative Lincheski.
You know, we disagree on this issue, Representative Gottwald, and that's fine, and you guys have the votes and you're going to pass it. You know, we understand that. But I do want to correct something, and I guess I would ask the chair to ask an independent arbiter here, either the Department of Revenue, Mr. Michael, Mr. Hines. I'll take either one of the farmers groups who are here. What Representative Gottwald just said is not accurate. This does not say farmers are going to pay less, and therefore nothing shifts on to anyone else, and the city just has less. That's not what happens in this law. And I'm willing to be corrected by anyone. It absolutely shifts the property taxes on to the homeowners. Absolutely. I had an amendment in property taxes to do just what Representative Gottwald just said, that said we're going to keep Green Acres, and what we'll do instead of shifting it on to everyone else and making them pay higher property taxes, we'll freeze it and we'll cut the cities and counties, and they won't be able to levy as much, and we'll ensure that there is no shifting. That amendment died. Mr. Chair, if we could get that corrected, I don't want to vote the wrong way if this is something changed here. Representative Lemire's bill absolutely is shifting property taxes that would normally under for classification be paid by farmers to homeowners and businesses and cabins in that same city. And if that's not right, I think we need to know that before we take this vote.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we did get information in the property tax division that there actually is $35 million in taxes shifted, and that's why this is a big program. That's why it has merited so much attention over the years, because it is a big tax break to a particular segment of our economy, and it's an important segment of our economy. But Representative Gottwald, I believe that you have also misled the committee on the intent and how it works, because my understanding is that in the law currently, land that is marginal and that is difficult to separate from the agricultural property is included in the Green Acres portion. My amendment deals with the rural preserve portion, which is the woodlots, the wetlands, the natural areas. And this is used not only by small farmers struggling in many parts of the state to get by, but it's used by hobby farmers, by people who have large estates that are holding on to it as a real estate development investment more than they are as a way to make a living as a farmer. And in particular in the metro area, that is a concern. When someone who is really sitting on what really could be questioned is in terms of its real purpose as a business, is shifting taxes, and it's primarily a real estate play. So it plays out differently, I understand, in all different parts of the state. But this will say that you have a minimal statement to your community that you are going to treat the land, the untillable land, in a way that honors the natural status of it. We're spending lots of money dealing with clean water, and this is an important thing. Mr. Chair, I would request a roll call vote.
Roll call vote having been requested. Very briefly, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, in a phrase, this is more government, and that's just exactly what our landowners don't need more of, is more bureaucracy controlling them. And so I would oppose this amendment.
Representative Loeffler renews her motion. There will be a roll call to pass the H002823 amendment. The committee legislative assistant will take the roll.
Representative Davids?
No.
Representative Loon? Representative Lynchusky?
Yes.
Representative Anderson?
No.
Representative Bills?
No.
Representative Biskins?
No.
Representative Carlson?
Yes.
Representative Crawford?
No.
Representative Dabney?
Yes.
Representative Depke?
No.
Representative Downey?
No.
Representative Joskowski?
No.
Representative Erickson?
No.
Representative Garofalo?
No.
Representative Gottwald?
No.
Representative Hortman?
Yes.
Representative Kiffmeyer? Representative Knuth?
Yes.
Representative Knuth?
Yes.
Representative Kunin?
Yes.
Representative Lesh?
Aye.
Representative Loeffler?
Yes.
Representative Mack?
No.
Representative Marquardt?
Yes.
Representative Myra?
No.
Representative Paymar?
Yes.
Representative Rukavina?
No.
Representative Runbeck?
No.
Representative Tilbury?
Yes.
Representative Wardlow?
No.
being 11 ayes and 17 noes, the motion does not prevail. Other amendments? Representative Lencheski, did you have an amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney?
I have an amendment being copied at this time.
Okay, could you describe the amendment, and we will not take any action until members have it in front of them?
Certainly. The chair and members may be surprised that I would have an amendment to Green Acres, since I don't believe there's any Green Acres land in my district enrolled in Green Acres. We do have some farms developing in Minneapolis. There's the mushroom farmer over in Representative Clark's district. And there's, as Representative Lesh, there may be some basement growing operations. I'm not clear on that, but
I'll support agriculture.
I believe it is the largest agricultural commodity by value in the state of California. I'm told. But I do have constituents who own farmland and have complained to me about the changes made in 2008 and since in the Green Acres program. I'm going to break from my lead and say I don't think we did right by farmers and those of us in the urban core concerned about land and conservation with the 2008 and since changes to Green Acres. So my amendment will simply repeal the 2008 and subsequent changes and take us back to 2007 statute for Green Acres.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. I think we know the amendment well enough to discuss it. We won't vote on it until we actually have it.
Oh, and Mr. Chair?
Representative Dabney?
I'd appreciate a roll call.
So would I. okay, so roll call hasn't been requested, but how long should the copying take here? Representative Lencheski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you're taking comments on the amendment, while we're waiting.
Yeah. I would just, and you're first on the list, but I would just say that on the amendment, I would respectfully speak against the Dabney Amendment in that that was a bill that I had to do exactly that, to just repeal the whole thing. I thought it was a great idea. But then it was brought to my attention that my great idea maybe wasn't such a great idea in that there were some things from the Legislative Auditor's Report and other testimony that said that maybe we shouldn't go quite that far. We should try and keep some of the good and not just throw everything out. So with that, I've also learned, I've got a question. Is Mr. Bobby King here from Lance? I saw him around. Mr. Peterson, could you please step down to the table for just a second? And I normally wouldn't do this, and we'll want to verify this. I have a question for Mr. Peterson. Then Mr. King represents the Land Stewardship Project. Do you know if they have a position on this? And if you can't answer that, that's fine. Does Lance, do you know?
Mr. Chairman, I am not sure of their position, but we could find him very quickly and have a position. Because they do have, he does have a comment, I think, on the bill. So
okay.
He would, yeah.
Okay, yeah. We don't have, Representative, just a little technical issue here. We don't have the amendment, so we can't actually have the roll call request yet. So once you do move your amendment, I'll request a roll call, or you can, or whoever would like to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The Department of Revenue, do you have any comments on that? If you'd support the Dabney Amendment that we don't have before us. And my point to find out what Mr. King from the Land Stewardship Project is thinking, because generally as a rule around this place, if you can get the Farm Bureau and the Farmers Union to agree on anything, that's really something. And if you throw the Land Stewardship Project on there too, that's even more amazing. So that's why I have the question. Okay, to the amendment that we do not have before us, Representative Lencheski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, I respectfully disagree. I think when you can get the two farmer groups to agree, that just means it's good for farmers. So I think we still have to care about all the non-farmers in this bill. And I just to the Dabney Amendment, of course, I oppose this amendment because as the Office of the Legislative Audit Report came out and cited all the problems, in attempting to change them, we corrected lots of them. So I don't want to see a repeal, but I think this amendment will be nice to see. So many legislators ran on If you elect me, I'll repeal Green Acres. So this is the time they get to take that vote to show that they would repeal Green Acres. And I think this amendment also shows that, in fact, what happened, Mr. Chair, was what's now going on in this bill is repealing almost none of the changes. So we had all these legislators who were saying all these changes were so terrible. We heard all these speeches on the House floor and in committee, and most of the changes are being retained in Representative Lemire's bill. So I do want to thank former Representative Demmer and Representative Coonan, Representative Marquardt, Representative Junkie, who worked diligently with the farm groups to do a huge overhaul of Green Acres. And Representative Lemire's bill is mostly retaining them. So for any member who thinks this bill repeals Green Acres, it doesn't. If you want to honor your campaign commitment that you ran on to repeal Green Acres, you'll need to be voting for the Dabney Amendment. And I would personally urge a no vote.
Representative Lincheski, do you have a copy of my campaign literature?
I do.
What did I say about Green Acres?
I don't have yours today. I do have the authors and Representative Kiffmeyer's and others in the room and the commitments they made on this regard.
Well, members, I would.
I don't know that you ran on it.
I would just look at this as honoring a commitment but actually making it better. Okay, so Representative Dabney moves the. Members, you have the language of the bill. I'm going to have Mr. Michael tell us what the correct motion would be.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the motion would be to delete everything after the enacting clause of the first committee engrossment and to insert instead the contents of House File 12 as introduced.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Like he said.
Okay, that's like he said. There's been a roll call requested by Representative Dabney. If the department, just very briefly, I think everybody knows what this is, so I don't know if we need a whole lot of discussion. I would just like to know a simple yes or no if the department supports the Dabney Amendment. Welcome to me. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is John Hagan. I am with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I would very much like to not insert myself or the department into this. I would like to say, though, that we do really very much like the 2A and the 2B provisions that came out of the 2008, and we like a separation between rural preserve and Green Acres for administrative purposes. Beyond that, the department does not have a position.
Okay. Very, very quickly, Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to hear from the assessors.
Okay, if Ms. Pinky could come down.
Just, Mr. Chair, we sent them through hell, so I just want to know if they're still there.
Ms. Pinky, what your position on the Dabney Amendment?
Thank you, Chair Davids and members. My name is Glory Pinky. I'm manager in Dakota County Assessing Services, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. And I also would not support a full repeal. Taxpayers and assessment administrators have tried very hard to keep up with all the changes. We've held lots of public meetings. We've mailed out lots of letters.
Ms. Pinky, do you support the amendment?
Yes. No, sir. Chair, I do not
thank
support
you.
Going back.
Any other questions on the Dabney Amendment? Seeing none, the committee legislature to assist Representative Dabney. Oh, absolutely.
Closing. Thank you very much, sir. I appreciate the respect. Members, I like the 2A and 2B. I just think we need a do-over. I think we need a chance to do our best work. This goes to the author's original intent on the introduction and gives us a chance to step back, do what some of us promised to do in the campaign, and get it right this time. With that, I ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Representative Lemire, do you support the Dabney Amendment?
Absolutely not, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lemire. The committee legislative assistant will take the roll.
Representative Davids?
No.
Representative Loon?
No.
Representative Lincheski?
Yes.
Representative Anderson?
No.
Representative Bills?
No.
Representative Biskins?
Pass.
Representative Carlson?
No.
Representative Crawford?
No.
Representative Dabney?
Pass.
Representative Depke?
No.
Representative Downey?
No.
Representative Drazkowski?
No.
Representative Erickson?
No.
Representative Garofalo?
Pass.
Representative Gottwalt?
No.
Representative Hortman?
Aye.
Representative Kiffmeyer?
No.
Representative Knuth?
No.
Representative Kunin?
No.
Representative Lesh?
Aye.
Representative Loeffler?
No.
Sorry?
No.
Representative Mack?
No.
Representative Marquardt?
No.
Representative Myra?
No.
Representative Paymar?
Aye.
Representative Rukavina?
Aye.
Representative Runbeck?
No.
Representative Tilbury?
Pass.
Representative Wardlow?
No.
Representative Biskins?
No.
Representative Dabney?
Yes.
Representative Garofalo?
Yes.
Representative Tilbury?
No.
Representative Lincheski?
No.
There being 6 ayes and 23 noes, the motion does not prevail. Are there any other amendments? Person Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have the A17 amendment, although, oh, I apologize, it's right here.
If the pages could please pass out the Lincheski A17 amendment. If you could please address your amendment, Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A17 amendment does what Representative Gottwalt said. This bill does not do that, but what this would do is ensure what Representative Gottwalt said was everybody who is going to receive Green Acres tax cuts would get those. They would all the farmers would still get their preferred tax status. But what it would do is it would then prevent the shift onto homeowners. And it would do that by capturing that amount of money, freezing the levy at that point. But what it does, if you want the details to the mechanics, Mr. Hines wrote it for me. This makes sure that folks who reside in districts with folks who are in Green Acres, I'm one of those too, that your residents will not pay those property tax burdens that are being shifted onto homeowners. That's it.
Is there anyone that doesn't understand the amendment or has questions on the amendment? With that, did you want a roll call, Representative Lincheski?
Well, if, you know, I don't know if did anybody want to ask Mr. Hines. I saw Representative Gottwalt make a face like that. I'm not sure if he knows what I'm doing here. I think what was asserted by Representative Gottwalt wasn't wrong, and we didn't have anyone correct that, even though I did request that. But now what was asserted by Representative Gottwalt would actually be true with this amendment, that there would be, farmers would be okay, but there would be no property tax shifts on to other homeowners and other properties.
Representative Gottwalt?
Briefly, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Lincheski, first of all, you mischaracterized my point earlier. I didn't see the reason to spend a lot of time on it. I simply made the point, which I think is accurate, that the community derives less money off of the unproductive land under Green Acres. It does, in fact. That's the whole point. They pay less taxes. Now, the other question that I have, Mr. Chair, on this one is, I assume there's a cost to this, and we probably want to be candid about what the cost is.
Yes. Ms. Schill, could you please address the issue of cost?
Mr. Chair and members, there would be a loss at the local level. Your revenue estimate includes $800,000 in taxes would shift onto other property types. So the local jurisdiction would come up short $800,000.
Okay. Representative Lincheski, then we'll take a vote on this. Representative Lincheski?
Well, Mr. Chair, and you know, if you want to check with Ms. Temple, someone else here, there is no cost to this amendment, just like there's no state cost to Green Acres, because it's just shifting from this taxpayer to that taxpayer. In every property tax issue, there's always the property tax refund program. But there is no cost to this amendment, and there's no cost to Representative Lemire's bill. That's not the issue here. That's my point. There is no state funding here. This is this property making that property pay their taxes. What this amendment does is ensure that that can't happen, that the farmer in Sauk Rapids, or I don't know what all cities you represent, can't shift his property taxes onto the homeowner in Sauk Rapids. Still gets the tax cut. The farmer still gets it. It's just we're not going to have it shifted onto other properties. So the net effect of that, of course, is the local unit of government has less to spend. In current law and in Representative Lemire's bill is the local unit of government does not have less to spend because the burden is being shifted onto somebody else. And, you know, I think if the wide, you know, the 5 million Minnesotans who are paying these property taxes understood that, I think there'd be a little different feeling about these kind of bills. You know, we have most people in Minnesota don't farm and don't receive this property tax subsidy. And, in fact, homeowners pay at 1% rate, and ag is classified at 0.5. So even just in the classification rate, farmers pay half the burden. And now we're going to, with Green Acres, we're making it even lower.
Okay, about 80 people here want to talk. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and my friend, Representative Lincheski, just so I make sure this is clear, then, when this bill was passed, the majority party did it with the intent of shifting the property tax burden from raising taxes on farmers then, and lowering the property taxes for suburban and city dwellers. Is that right?
President Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not just suburban and city, it's everywhere. There isn't a single rural legislator in the state of Minnesota whose preponderance of constituents are non-farmers. It's everywhere. And yes, that's right, because if we, and you know, I think part of the problem here in these Green Acres debates is as the redistricting continues through the legislature, we're going to see people eliminate Green Acres. When people really understand the unfairness in this program, what this amendment is attempting to do, to answer your question, did the majority flip it back to give homeowners a tax cut? Yes, it did. That's exactly what it did. And going backward is giving homeowners a property tax increase, noting, so you could say, oh yeah, you're preferring homeowners, the majority preferred homeowners over farmers. Homeowners pay 1% classification, ag is 0.5.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Lincheski, when you passed this bill, did you hold farmers harmless? Did you have an amendment attaching that to protect farmers that way?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd like to eliminate the program. But we have to compromise around here, and I think as time goes on and people understand this program more and more and understand that the lowest effective tax rates in the state of Minnesota on any properties types is on ag right now. You know, you just look at who's the worst deal in the state of Minnesota is a business because they're paying at a higher classification rate, and the best deal in Minnesota is a farmer. And we were divided in our caucus. We have a lot of folks in our caucus who represent these communities and fought me back. And so I had to compromise. You all have to work that out, too. But I do think as we erode the credibility of these programs, we will see these programs disappear.
Mr. Chairman, my opinion is that we did not have this provision when this was passed. We should not have this provision when we modify it. We should be consistent, and I'll be opposing the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'll withdraw the amendment.
Okay.
Instead, Mr. Chair, if I could offer the A24.
Representative Lincheski moves the A24 amendment.
And I think here it is. Well, Mr. Chair.
If we could get the amendment passed out, Representative Lincheski, if you could please start describing. We are going to vote on this at noon, the bill itself. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lincheski.
And just to, you know, I can see, you know, people are not wanting to choose between whose taxes they're going to raise. And, I respect that. It's a lot easier for me, who only has a small amount of Green Acres, to take the positions I'm taking. But I'm trying to take a statewide position when we already have significant reductions for these properties, and now we're going to shift them onto others. You know, this amendment merely, it allows Representative Lemire to do what he wants, which is increase property tax burdens for everyone else. It just puts it on the property tax statement. And, Mr. Chair, I'd like a roll call All this will say on this amendment is when you receive your property tax statement, just like now we list how much market value homestead credit you get, how much your property taxes are higher due to the existence of Green Acres or lower. That's all it does. Truth in advertising, transparency, so property taxpayers can see the shifting that's going on. I'd ask for a roll call, Mr. Chair.
We have a roll call. Any further discussion? The Representative Erickson.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I was just asking both the Farm Bureau and the Farmers Union what amount the ag industry adds to our economy. It's at least $30 billion, and as far as jobs, it's between 20 and 30% of our jobs. I think we need to keep that in mind, too. What we're doing here is a strong statement in our legislation that Representative Lemire here is to support what that industry does for our economy.
Representative Lemire, do you support the A24 amendment?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Lencheski renews her motion that the H0012824 amendment be passed. The committee legislative assistant will take the roll.
Representative Davids?
No.
Representative
and members, I'm sorry, please speak into the microphone, but we're having a little trouble hearing up here.
Representative Loon?
No.
Representative Lencheski?
What'd she say?
She said yeah.
Representative Lencheski?
Yes.
Oh, yes, okay.
Representative Anderson?
No.
Representative Bills?
No.
Representative Biskins?
No.
Representative Carlson?
Yes.
Representative Crawford?
No.
Representative Dabney?
Yes.
Representative Depke?
No.
Representative Downey?
No.
Representative Joskowski?
No.
Representative Erickson?
No.
Representative Garofalo?
No.
Representative Gottwald?
No.
Representative Hortman?
Yes.
Representative Kiffmeyer?
No.
Representative Knuth?
Yes.
Representative Coonan?
No.
Representative Lesh?
Aye.
Representative Loeffler?
Yes.
Representative Mack?
No.
Representative Marquardt?
No.
Representative Myra?
No.
Representative Paymar?
Yes.
Representative Rukavina?
No.
Representative Runbeck?
No.
Representative Tilbury?
Yes.
Representative Wardlow?
No.
There being 20 no's and 9 ayes, the motion does not prevail. Any other amendments? Okay, I would like to bring, will be Representative Lemire renews his motion to House File 12 as amended, be recommended pass to the Ways and Means Committee. I'd like to bring down Bobby King, but in the meantime, we're going to Representative. Oh, he left again. I just want to clear the record. The land stewardship project is either for the bill as amended or against it. Representative Marquardt Biskins. Oh, excuse me. Representative Biskins to the motion.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I heard you say that Representative Lemire moves. And I don't think we can do that.
Thank you very much, Representative Biskins. I will move House File 12 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Ways and Means Committee. Thank you, because that would have been tough for him to move that. Okay, Representative Marquardt, and then I believe we will take the roll. Representative Loon?
I would just like to request a roll call on this.
Roll call having been requested, Representative Marquardt, and then we will take the roll. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And just a couple comments. First of all, in regards to the vote on the Daphne amendment, I found that very interesting. Despite all the political theater the last few years of how we needed to totally repeal things, the vote was that things weren't so bad after all on what we did in 08 and 09. So I find that a little interesting on that vote. But to the larger picture things, and I think we just have to take a step back. You know, Mr. Hagan from the Department of Revenue talked about all the different changes to Green Acres and kind of all the controversy in the past. And I strongly support Green Acres. I think it's a very valuable program. And my major concern with all of this has been the long-term viability of the program and the fact that it has confidence by all members, even those who don't get the preference, for example, metro legislators and so forth. And when this came out, you know, this OLA report, this isn't just one person deciding we want to take a look at Green Acres. You know how that process works. You know, it's legislators kind of do a survey, then it rises to the top. So by the time there's actually a study, there's a lot of concern about it. And one of the major concerns, there are several, was kind of this fact of people were getting the Green Acres on land that was untillable, some that was used primarily for hunting. And that created a huge, I think, confidence problem. And my concern here by reducing this rural reserve program is we're going to be back revisiting this. And I just really thought the preserve could maybe tighten things up and finally, for at least the period of time, put things to rest. But I'm going to be voting no. And like I said, I'm a strong supporter of the program, but I think these changes in the long term are going to not solve the problems that we've seen in the last, 30 years or 40 years since it was passed. So, members, just my comment.
Thank you very much, Representative Marquardt. The committee legislative assistant will take the role on the David's motion that House File 12, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the Ways and Means Committee.
Representative Davids.
Yes, I almost said no. Yes, 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 I'm for it. Yeah. Yeah.
Representative Loon?
Aye.
Representative Lencheski?
No.
Representative Anderson?
Yes.
Representative Bills?
Yes.
Representative Biskins?
Yes.
Representative Carlson?
No.
Representative Crawford?
Yes.
Representative Dabney?
Pass.
Representative Depke?
Yes.
Representative Downey?
Yes.
Representative Juskowski?
Yes.
Representative Erickson?
Yes.
Representative Garofalo?
Yes.
Representative Gottwald?
Yes.
Representative Hortman?
No.
Representative Kiffmeyer?
Yes.
Representative Knuth?
No.
Representative Coonan?
Yes.
Representative Lesh?
No.
Representative Loeffler?
No.
Representative Mack?
Yes.
Representative Marquardt?
No.
Representative Myra?
Yes.
Representative Paymar?
No.
Representative Rukavina?
Yes.
Representative Runbeck?
Yes.
Representative Tilbury?
No.
Representative Wardlow?
Yes.
Representative Dabney?
Yes.
There being 20 ayes and 9 noes, the motion does prevail. And members, I would just say I agree with Representative Lencheski when she said as bills make their way through the process, we do compromise to try and do the common good for this great state. Good government all the time. Members, we are adjourned.